Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. I was going to do Buddhism 401, but maybe we should do 101. Maybe we'll do everything. We've been reading in the mornings, we've been having some basic readings from the texts, which outline what we call the gradual path. And the Buddha, in the text, when he was teaching, he'd lay out, or he'd see in people's minds, a kind of gradual way of introducing the ideas which lead to liberation. And there are a progression of ideas, each teaching being a foundation for both worldly happiness and for enlightenment. So it's like an accumulation of goodness, accumulation of strength, accumulation of insight, which leads to more and more profound well-being. And it's interesting, the first aspect the Buddha would emphasize is generosity rather than meditation, generosity. And so the texts we were reading indicated the importance of a heart which is not tight, which is not self-serving, which is not self-obsessed, to say the least, a mind which has the capacity to give, to look outwards, to have empathy. Because generosity, when generosity is lived, then there's a certain kind of confidence in the heart, because one doesn't need so much for oneself. And there's also a kind of space in the mind. One isn't trying to hold on to things for one's own selfish ends. So generosity is a foundation for enlightenment, and it's a foundation for well-being, it's a foundation for happiness. And I think that's very important to remember, because when we talk about Buddhism and we talk about maybe meditation or understanding the mind, it can sound kind of self-obsessed and self-concerned and have no sense of altruism or any sense of larger social responsibility. But actually, the very first part is generosity. And that's oftentimes a given in a Buddhist culture. So in a Buddhist culture, say Thailand or Sri Lanka or Burma, that's taught right from the get-go, you know, that this is an important aspect. Not that it's not taught in Western culture, but it's a kind of in the context of Buddhist ideas. So someone who comes through a Buddhist culture, they know that's part of the Buddhist training. And sometimes in the West, we come to it from an interest in philosophy or meditation or psychology, and people enter in that way. Not that they're not generous, but they sometimes haven't been given that kind of direct realization that meditation is not really going to proceed very, very well if the heart's not generous. And from a heart from a lifestyle which is based on being socially responsible to one's family and one's commitments, there is a sense of place. This is my place. This is my society. This is who I am in this society in a good way. This is what I do. I do. When people ask us, "What do you guys do?" I do monk. But what does a monk do? Oh, we do kindness and things like that. Rather than, do I make Pepsi Cola cans or manufacture something? So generosity is a really beautiful quality in and of itself, but it's not the end point. It's part of the method, part of the foundation. And we call that Dana Bharami. And interestingly enough, then the next aspect that the Buddha expounds on in the gradual teaching is morality. It's an ethical life. It's a life which is lived in sensitivity to the well-being of others. So non-violence, non-corruption, communication which is truthful, not harsh on others, sobriety, fidelity, these kinds of things. And these lead to a sense of a heart which is free from remorse, plus a society which is trustworthy. The sense of our social cohesion and our sense of not being afraid of each other, because we are morally responsible. And so to take these two together, generosity and morality, they're really you can see when they're in place and done well, the mind has some stability, where a mind which is stingy or caught up in corrupt activity or violent activity, that mind is not going to be very stable. And then in the gradual teaching, it talks about the divine qualities of consciousness, where divinity now is not as, say, a being outside of us, but rather that which is divine as more like a metaphor in the heart. And the divine qualities that we can experience as human beings, because as human beings we experience animal feelings. We have fear, we have sexuality, we have power, you know, we have violence, those kinds of things. As human beings we can experience those, but also we have the capacity for compassion, for joy, for light in the heart, for equanimity and peace. And these we would kind of, sometimes we talk about those as the divine qualities of human consciousness, and they in themselves are very beautiful to develop. So that just the ideas of like goodwill is an aspect of non-selfishness, isn't it? When I think of you, and I think may your life be one which is blessed with goodness. You know, may you succeed in your efforts. May you not suffer. You know, if you have any diseases, may you be quickly healed, and may your family be well, and so on and so forth. That's a kind of a movement away from selfishness, and when it's lived fully, we say it's a kind of divine quality. Compassion, you know, the ability to empathize with someone's suffering, joy, the capacity to empathize with beauty in others, beauty in nature, and the peace of the mind, stability of peace of the mind, which is open to life but not just caught up with praise and blame and success and failure and things like that. And these we would say are the opening of the heart, and they're very much to do with empathy, that as a human being I can look out into the world in a selfish way, how much can I get for myself, or I can look at the world and say, I wonder what it feels like to be this person, and I see a person suffering, oh, that must be difficult, how can I be of service. And so it's kind of aspects of generosity and compassion. So you can see when you start to look at the teaching in that way, there's a lot to, you know, there's a lot that we can cultivate without even cultivating the life of meditation. And these are not trivial matters. They're very important. And you see that creates a kind of foundation of confidence, stability, and well-being, from which we, you know, the next part of the teaching points to the beauty or the excitement or happiness of sense experience, but also the distracting quality of sense experience, that a mind which is always going out into sights and sounds and smells and tastes and activities and thoughts in the future is a mind which is active but sometimes very, very restless. So the teaching kind of points to the beauty of a heart which can stay home, and the downfall the negative possibilities of always being distracted by the senses. Not that they're bad, you know, senses aren't sense experiences it is. But a mind which is always going out is a mind which is kind of restless. And so the Buddha's recommendation is on the beauty of the quiet mind, the beauty of the meditative mind, the beauty of the contemplative mind, which requires some sense restraint. Not rejection of sense experience, but sense restraint. And that you, of course, find in meditation as you start to try to sit and be quiet, and you find the mind always going off into thinking and planning and organizing or whatever. You say, oh, it's quite hard to train the mind. It's quite hard to train the mind. It's not easy. And yet you also see that that's where we live. You know, we live in this consciousness. And if we don't train the heart and mind, then, of course, we're victims to external experiences. You're not really, really free. So when external experiences are beautiful, nice, and comfortable, we feel well, but when they're not, we feel confused, because that's where our refuge is. So the recommendation on developing a heart of meditation, you start to put all that together, you have quite a well-developed human being, really. You know, if the whole world could have all those qualities in place, and it would be a rather marvelous place. So these are both beautiful, and we say that it's beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, beautiful in the end. These are qualities which themselves are very rewarding and very fulfilling, both socially and individually. But also they are a method, or they're a foundation for deeper insight. So I wanted to talk about something actually difficult. Difficult maybe intellectually or difficult. When we talk about ego or self-view and so on in Buddhism, there are sort of various ways which that's pointed to, and part of the Buddhist teaching is to develop strong silence in the mind, so that we can look very carefully at the way things are and see if we're making any errors in our perceptions which cause us to suffer. And the errors of perception around ego are very, very real when we perceive things in the wrong way. So the first sort of aspect of that kind of ego reflection or what we call self-view is to begin to very simply begin to objectify our emotional experiences rather than be the subject of them. So what we call the Sakkaya Ditti or personality view, we recommended that we say, if I feel annoyed at something, or I feel, let's say, I feel angry at someone, that certainly I feel angry towards person A, but also I can reflect, I can see anger is a condition that has arisen. And this would be a removal of self-identity, but not self-responsibility. So it no longer just say, you know, that person is terrible, why did they do that to me? Or I shouldn't be angry, but I would say, oh, anger feels this way. So it's an awakening to the conscious experience of, for example, anger, but it's no longer taking it personally, and yet being responsible. And so that is the sort of entry into looking at consciousness as a stream of events. So in Buddhism, we talk about a relative truth and ultimate truth. And relative truth is just the ways that we function as social beings, and the appropriate way to act and speak and live in our social context. So if I feel angry, I don't dump it on anyone. That's what we call relative truth. I have responsibility not to hurt others. So I might feel angry at someone, but my responsibility as a monk is not to not hurt others. And so I try not to do that. I try not to act in that way. I have a responsibility towards the right speech and so on. But then as a contemplative, I try to get out of the me and the other person duality and just start to look at consciousness as a flow of events. Consciousness as a flow of feelings and memories and thoughts and ideas and emotions. That's what we call stream of consciousness. And that leads to ultimate truth. That's the ultimate way of looking at things. So this is what we would say is the contemplative part of Buddhism. And this isn't like analyzing oneself all the time. It's like observing the very nature of consciousness, the very nature of emotional life, the very nature of physical life. How is it? How does it work? So that's the first step, is to not take, as my teacher would say, don't take it personally. And yet there is social responsibility. So if I feel, say, in a monastery, if I feel disappointed by something, socially I might have a responsibility to say, well, that was wrong, you shouldn't do that. So I'm the senior monk, so I have sort of social responsibility. But the very, very feeling of disappointment is also something you have to understand, because disappointment is a part of being human. And if I step back and I say, oh, disappointment feels this way, and then I see how, well, what happens with that disappointment? Well, when I attach to it, then I want to blame someone. You know, you shouldn't be like that, you shouldn't be like that. Or then I want to blame myself, I shouldn't be like that. And the disappointment just keeps festering in the mind. Me, you. I shouldn't be like this, you shouldn't be like that. And so I become kind of enslaved to something like disappointment. I don't see disappointment as an object in consciousness that comes and goes. When I begin to see disappointment as just a natural phenomena, it arises and it ceases, I begin to have a peacefulness with disappointment. A peacefulness with disappointment, rather than you never feel disappointed, because that's not real life. I begin to be able to witness, just like I can witness to physical discomfort and physical pain and not suffer. Right? I can feel discomfort in my body and meditating. My knees are painful and my hips and so on. And I just notice, so pain feels this way. I can move out of it, but I can also notice that pain is one thing, but suffering, mental suffering, is another thing. It's the same with disappointment. Disappointment is an emotional kind of discomfort, which I can notice and say, oh, yeah, it feels this way. When I begin to abide like that, then I'm the witness to nature. I'm the witness to Dharma. I'm a witness to this flow of consciousness. So we call this the Sakkaya Ditti, personality view. And we would say that you don't really enter into the path of Buddhism, of Buddhist contemplation, until you start to look at stream of consciousness rather than be this self-entity always struggling and fighting with the world. So in that way, what's very important there is the aspects of heart, because if one has been practicing compassion, one has been contemplating compassion, then that compassion is no longer about me and you, it's about an attitude to all conditions in nature. And so, as Ajahn Sumedho would say, it all belongs. The disappointments, the angers, the fears, the joys and sorrows, they all belong. They're all a part of nature. They're not right or wrong. They all belong. And that's why compassion and awareness are so very important in Buddhism. Because without compassion, we very easily just go to criticism or blame or repression or suppression or whatever. But the compassionate heart is something, is an attitude that we have, and we're trying to have that sense of kindness towards each moment. Because if we are kind and we are accepting, then we have a chance to look and understand. But if we're rejecting, I shouldn't be this way, you shouldn't be that way, I should be good all the time, you shouldn't disappoint me, blah, 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 then of course we're just victims of circumstance. So in our practice, we start to establish this way of consciousness, which is actually very broad and very open and very present and very accepting. Not condoling foolishness and so on, but just accept, well, life is this way now. It belongs. It all belongs. You know, the pain belongs, the disappointment belongs, the fear belongs, the joy. It all belongs. And this is a wonderful kind of movement in consciousness, because we're no longer just picking like at a buffet of things we want. Our minds are very open to this now. This life is this way, it feels this way. And some sense of ego falls away from that. Some sense of ego investment or ego attachment begins to fall away. Because there's breath, there's openness, there's space and consciousness. Even though the experiences might be unpleasant or difficult. Whereas tendency to blame myself or others is very, very close to the suffering kind of mind. So that's the sort of first level of ego consciousness. Now the difficult bit. So the difficult bit is, you guys are my guinea pigs in this. There's several suttas that the Buddha gives to practitioners who have that kind of grounding now. You know, they have the grounding in a mind which is quiet. They have the grounding in a heart which is open. They have a grounding in a life of goodness and sense restraint. So there's a kind of stillness there. And so I've been reading one sutta, but the Kalakarama Sutta, but another one is the Sutta to Bahia, which I'm more familiar with. And I've talked about this before, but in the sutta, the way the story goes is that Bahia is an ascetic at the time of the Buddha, and he feels that he has attained to final enlightenment, and a relative of his comes along and says, well, probably not actually, but there is this teacher, Gautama Buddha, who lives in Magadha, and if you go see him, then you'll probably get some insight into what level of attainment you have. And so Bahia then is very, very inspired by hearing that there is a Buddha, and he goes and without resting he travels to Rajagaha, I think, and he finds the monks are on alms round. He goes to the monastery monks at Chetawana, I think, and the monks are on alms round. So he goes into the town and he tries to find the monks wandering on alms round, and he finds the Buddha at the head of a row of monks, and he asks him, he falls to his knees and asks him for teaching. So he's so inspired and so kind of hungry for knowledge, hungry for insight, which I sometimes look at that and I think, you know, we hear so much Dharma and Dharma Seed and YouTube, and can you imagine like this ascetic who hears about a Buddha and then he travels by foot across India or something, and then he gets to the Buddha. You know, you imagine the fervor he'd have. Rather, it's different than kind of listening to a YouTube video, or not that those are bad, but imagine the fervor now of a, and he's already, he has a lot of attainment. You know, he has a lot of insight. He's not a beginner in that sense. And so the Buddha says, well, that's not a good time now. We're on alms round. And Bahia kind of insists and says, oh, just a little bit of teaching, not much. And the Buddha a second time says, no, this isn't a good time. And a third time, Bahia presses the Buddha, and as it's often laid out in the text, when the Buddha's asked three times, he sometimes does respond. And on this occasion, he says, okay, Bahia, I shall give you a teaching in brief. And so this is the difficult bit now. I gotta concentrate. Let's see if I get it right. So Bahia, you should train thus. So he's offering him a training now, not a philosophy training. Bahia, you should train thus. In the seen, there should be just the seen. In the heard, there should be just the heard. In the sensed, there should be just the sensed. And in the sensed, it would be taste, bodily feeling, and smell. So in the seen, there should be just the seen. So this is a training now, okay? This is something that he's asking Bahia to do. In the seen, there should be just the seen. In the heard, there should be just the heard. In the sensed, there should be just the sensed. In the cognized, there should be just the cognized. And when Bahia, in the seen, there is just the seen. In the heard, there is just the heard. In the sensed, there is just the sensed. And in the cognized, there is just the cognized. Then Bahia, there will be no here, no there, no in between. Just this is the end of suffering. Now that's rather difficult. So that's Buddhism 404. So what it's pointing to there, what I think, is the second aspect of ego, which we call asmimana, or self-conceit. Now this is very difficult because what he's pointing to is a kind of, you see, when you look at me, you assume a person is here. You assume there's Viradhamma. When I look at the door, I assume there's a door there. And from that assumption, I create a world. Now, I'm not saying there's not a door, because if I walked up to the door, and you could say, well, you're saying there's not a door, you walk up to it, okay, walk through it. Right? You make a complete fool of me. But this is very difficult because it's saying we make assumptions. We make assumptions about the world, but all we have is sense data. All we have is all we have. Like what you have, you have that the sense data coming in, and from that we create a world. Now, so he's asking Bahia, in the seen there's just the seen, hold it there. In the heard there's just hold it there, hold just heard this and heard, cognize this just the cognized, and see what happens. And this is one of the difficult, you find this in Indian philosophy, the end of the subject-object duality. Because the assumption that there is this objective world out there also creates the idea that there is a subject. There's a me and there's a world out there. And that's the root cause of suffering. That's the root cause of suffering. So to actually... Now, as a philosophy, when you read that, you think, oh, gosh, that's gobbledygook. Or you think, I have to believe it or disbelieve it. But here, you know, he's saying to Bahia, you should train in this way. You train in this way. When you notice your own thoughts going through, you assume a thinker. Your thoughts will be coming through and you'll assume there's a thinker thinking the thoughts. And all you have is the data of thoughts going through the mind. When you feel feelings of pleasure or pain, when you see a person and so on, you assume a lot of things. And not that that's wrong, I'm not saying that's wrong, but this particular avenue of investigation, of research, is an avenue that the Buddha is recommending, because his insight was transcendent. It wasn't just a kind of... It wasn't just altruism, you know, it wasn't just psychological balance. He did realize something which was profoundly different. And this kind of avenue of investigation, you need a very quiet mind to do that. And it's not so much you believe it, you become kind of observe in this way. Now, usually what we say, the vision of that indicates there's a door there, and when I touch it, there's a door there. I opened it, there's a door there. It indicates that. And the Buddha's saying, well, what it also indicates is quite often these visual things indicate greed, hatred, and delusion. So when I see something I like, when I see something dislike, what arises is a sense of me and that, my liking and my disliking. And the Buddha's asking it to see, well, is there an entity? Is there the subject object? Is there a person there actually? And so what he's saying, the way to do that is to begin to make the mind quiet, have a generous heart, live a moral life. So that could be several lifetimes work in itself. But having that foundation, where to go? Where to go with that? Just with the silence of the mind, which I think most of us experience in meditation. But then we step out of the meditation and our minds are churned up again by things. Or is there a profound insight that puts a whole different dimension on it? And in the Sutta to Bahia, and there are several like that. They're not very often we find them, but there's several like that. In the scene, there's just the scene. So when you notice your mind thinking, watch that assumption of a thinker. I mean, it's very subtle, but just... Or when you're just with someone, just observe them, just as sense contact. It's not great for cocktail conversation, I realize. I was doing that the other morning. We were having a discussion on something. I was a real deadbeat because I was just watching contact, contact in the mind. But the insights that the Buddha had, I mean, they had levels of commonality, but also levels of uniqueness that it took a Buddha to realize that. So when you start to practice in this way, start to do that. Watch your kind of the whole assumptions you make about the world. And so if you drop all those assumptions, you drop all the assumptions you make, what do I have now? I have this data here, I have that. That in itself is very silent, just to do that. You have to let go of past and future. Or if past and future come up, you see that's just a thought in the mind. Your mind has to be quiet, very, very quiet to do this. Very, very quiet. So you start to set up your practice as a mind which is just very, very open and accepting and attentive to the way things are. So you're always not, sometimes we are so object-oriented in our meditation that we kind of lock ourselves like a horse in a stall. So we can hold on to an object of meditation and keep the mind still. But as soon as you open, you take your attention away from the object, it's like you open the doors of the horse stall and the horse goes off running to the races again. So we're not just trying to hold the mind onto an object to keep it quiet, because eventually you tire of that. But we're trying to calm the mind down, get the mind, learn how to do that, make the mind happy, make the mind, let it experience well-being. But then apply these more refined kind of investigations into the way things are. So then you stop even like choosing an object. You have to have the mind quiet enough to do this. You just stop choosing an object and you begin to watch how there is contact. There's contact, like you hear the fan, feel the hands. And you start to really intuit, the whole creation of me sitting here listening to a fan, is that true? Experientially, is that true? Is that really? And I begin to intuit, there is just contact feeling. And this begins to take your mind to what we call emptiness. And when we talk about sunyata in Buddhism, emptiness of a sense of self, emptiness of the subject-object duality. And then you begin to see when the Buddha says the world arises and ceases in this fathom-long body. Not just as a kind of metaphor, but really, there's just this sense data that's all you've got. Just take that. No assumptions. And the mind begins to touch the kind of consciousness that was empty of ego, empty of subject-object duality. And begin to touch something that's very, very peaceful, very peaceful. Which is not the same as having a constructed meditation which is peaceful, but the next starts to fall apart when all the conditions are not there. And as you touch that kind of sense of emptiness in this sense is used as a good, in a good way, you begin to appreciate the beauty of that. Any description of it is always dualistic. You begin to incline more towards that than to the objects, because the objects are always subject to change, subject to suffering, subject to disappointment, and so on. And your mind begins to find an abiding in emptiness, which is an abiding that the Buddha recommended we learn to abide with. And then you still open the door when you have to open the door. You still live in relative truth. And this is the paradox of Buddhism that when you talk in these more refined ways, it says, how can you live your life like that? But you do. You do live your life. You live your life better, actually, because there is less need. There's less need on that relative truth. So there's still responsible living and social justice and washing the dishes and making sure your toenails are clipped, and from the mundane to, but you begin to see your real refuge is not in a kind of sense experience. It's something sort of behind you. Now, so these are the more difficult bits of Buddhism, but obviously for someone like me, they're the more interesting. But all of it is good. And all of it's, you're always practicing, you're always doing generosity, you're always doing morality, always opening the heart, always sort of cultivating the stillness of mind. And that has a kind of beautiful strength. You know, the stream of consciousness is now no longer just a victim to circumstance, a victim to emotions or the success or failure of my life. The consciousness now has a kind of power and strength that that has both insight and it has good karma. You know, have the good karma of living a good life, good karma of living a life which is free from remorse, and has this confidence of insight, and then we keep deepening that understanding. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Annamaya no vada dhamma kataya sadhu karam dadamase.
Sadhu, 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 anumodami.
Finish with the closing homage.